This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. And at Interactive Brokers, you don't have to wait for the markets to open. With around-the-clock trading, you can trade over 10,000 U.S.-listed stocks and ETFs, U.S. equity index futures and options, U.S. Treasury bonds, and more. IBKR's overnight trading helps you stay ahead by allowing you to react instantly to market-moving news and economic events whenever they happen. Capture more market opportunities and trade on your timetable during local market hours or whenever it's convenient for you. Enjoy bond trading with no markups, no built-in spreads, and low, transparent commissions, which, well, can help you improve your returns. Rated a top online broker, Interactive Brokers has won awards from Barron's, Investopedia, and StockBrokers.com, and has been Benzinga's number one overall online broker for bonds 4 years in a row. The best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Open an Interactive Brokers account today and discover more trading opportunities around the clock. Learn more at ibkr.com/aroundtheclock. Interactive Brokers is a member of SIPC.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
March needs a miraculous ending to force green. But gold, well, it continues its ascent. And tariffs to hit foreign manufactured car companies. But Tesla's on the right side of that trade. Our guest this week is David Gaffin, the breaking news editor at Reuters. All this and much more on episode number 914 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Here we are about to enter into the month of April. Andrew Horowitz here. I am very excited about where we're going because this particular month that's coming up is right in line with what we do here each and every week, month after month, year after year on the Disciplined Investor Podcast, because this show is where we explore the ideas that shape our financial futures, both yours and mine. I mean, I get the opportunity to speak to some great guests that are the best in the industry every single week as I bring those conversations to you. But really what's happening is I'm learning a lot as well along the way. And this week, we're going to talk about something that's near and dear to me. And you know that it's financial literacy. We talked about that in December, that we were going to bring on a lot of people to really bring up the educational component of what we're doing here each and every week. And I think that we've done that so far this year. And we're going to continue that, particularly into April, as April is Financial Literacy Month. So what better time to dive right into it, right? It's going to start tomorrow. And we talk about financial literacy. You hear that word bantered around and talked around, and you see it on the various TV shows and on all that. And I got to ask, what do you think that really means? Like, what is financial literacy? Is this, I understand what stocks and margin and options are, or what is it? What is it? Because I don't think it's really just about that. I don't think it's just about understanding the definition of a stock or a bond or balancing your checkbook. I think it's a lot more. And I think it's about understanding actually how money works, how it flows in and out of our lives and the psychology of it, what we do with it, how we deal with it, how we earn it. The components of not just investing, and that's why we had Daniel Crosby on recently talking about the psychology of money. That was what we talked about. But we want to understand how we can use it to create opportunity, stability. And I think really the most important thing, which we've talked about so many times, is financial freedom. The freedom to be able to do the things that you want to do without feeling suffocated by having to work in a job that you absolutely despise or having to rely on someone else to pay for your, your phone bill, your food, maybe being in a situation where you have no money in the future and you're just relying on the government. Hopefully, they will still have a Social Security system there in order to provide. Well, here's the truth. Here's some of the things that we really need to know. That without financial literacy, all of us are just, we're walking around in circles. We're unable to really navigate, a complex world of finance. And we're doing it kind of blindfolded. Because we live in a time of not only credit cards, right? It's not just cash. It's not bartering. But we have all sorts of ways to pay for things. We have our mortgages, a lot of debt outstanding because of a big house, a big nut that we have on a regular basis that we have to spend. We have investments. We have student loans, cryptocurrencies out there. And the economy is moving. It's shaking. It's doing. And then not to mention the craziness of all the news flow that's happening. And yet, many of us really were never taught how to understand, dare I say, master these tools or even recognize the pitfalls that each of them have. And that lack of that inability, that deficiency that we have can really lead to a lot of stress, lead to debt and missed opportunities, or even worse, sometime in the future, maybe even a financial crisis. You know, at the same time, I don't think Financial Literacy Month is just about highlighting the challenges. It's more about empowering you to take control. I think it's an invitation to ask questions. It's your opportunity to seek guidance and ultimately to expand your knowledge, expand your understanding of what's going on in the area of finance, right? That's the whole point of it. And I guess whether it's understanding the power of compounding interest or learning to budget like a real boss, you know, how about this? Finally tackling your retirement plan, right? Who hasn't gotten to that yet? The steps you take today can really make a difference, a huge difference tomorrow. So here's my challenge for you. I want you to commit to learning one new thing about finances this month. That's just in a whole month. You get 30-something days, you can learn one thing about finances, whether it's how to create an emergency fund or whether it's the pick of the right credit card, diving into the world of index funds. Make Financial Literacy Month your launch pad into greater financial freedom, because this is going to be the time that is well spent and you'll really pay off in the future. So over the next few episodes, we're going to explore. We're going to spend some time talking about tips and maybe untangling myths about finance and maybe even having some fun with it. We do that from time to time. And as we do and as we go through these episodes, we spend the time on a variety of topics. We know that. And sometimes we talk, right? And you listen and you hear terms and you hear things that make sense. And then all of a sudden somebody says something and you're like, oh, I don't know what that means. And you keep going. I want you to do me a favor. I want you to change the way you listen, because I don't want you to listen, just simply listen and not have a full grasp and understanding of what's being talked about. So I want you to listen with intent. I want you to spend time understanding what's being said. Stop the roll, play it back. If you don't understand something, just take a moment and push that pause button. Look up the meaning, come back and, hey, that's what that was about, right? Because it's much better for you to have this listening and learning experience rather than just listening. Because financial literacy, it's not just a skill. It's a mindset. It's a journey. It's a destination that we're going to get to. And ultimately, in a way, it's a form of self-care. We will all need to practice that on a regular basis. And we're going to continue to walk this path together towards your financial freedom. I can promise you that. So here's what I'm going to say and finalize and kind of end on this subject. That being financially literate, it's not about being perfect and knowing everything. It's about being informed and intentional. And the best time to start? Well, we know it was yesterday, but if not then, when? Well, today. So let's get going with our financial literacy and get on with that, okay? We're going to keep on talking about this for the next month or so. Now, one of the things that we have to talk about for a moment as we start thinking about what's going on in the markets is gold. I mean, it's been on fire. It's been one of the best trades of gold in a very, very long time. Can't ignore it. I mean, it's up, what, 16% year to date? Like 33% for 1 year? And you got to wonder, like, what's happening? Why? Everybody's asking why. I did a little research, and we've been thinking about this, and we've been talking about this, and there are, I think, some fundamental and some technical reasons what's going on. And clearly, you look at a chart, and you'll understand that gold broke out of a long-term, very long, many-year, multi-year resistance point, and since then, it's just been on fire. So what really is happening here? So, okay, here's something. First of all, we have economic uncertainty. We know that, right? We have instability in the markets. We have concern about the leadership. We have, you know, people looking for safe haven locations. Well, gold fits that bill. And we have things, you know, inflation and trade wars and geopolitics. That's all driven demand in gold. We also have central bank purchases. We know this. We see the data. Because central banks globally have been buying gold to diversify their reserves and reduce their resilience on the, you know, the reliance on the U.S. dollar. So that's something to be thinking about. People also looking at it as an inflation hedge, because it's traditionally, that's what it does, right? Gold is a hedge against inflation. We have rising debt levels on a global basis. We have recession fears that are going on. So that's appealing to those people. Now, the other thing we have is investor sentiment, psychology, and technical indicators, key price points, like that $3,000 per ounce that we just saw come and go recently. And that does things like it sparks psychological the momentum in the name. And people are worried. They have a FOMO. There's gold FOMO going on. And then we have trade policies, right? These aggressive trade policies, the tariffs, adds to the uncertainty. But here's some other things that are going on too. Because if you really look inside of what's happening with gold, and I'm not a gold bug, and we don't own a lot of it for clients. We have some in our global allocations inside of our commodity basket. But we have things like in India. There's different gold buying seasons. And they have 1.4 billion people that are thinking about this on a regular basis. But you look at the season that usually aligns with various festivals and holidays, wedding seasons. You have like this Akshaya Tritiya, which is April 30th. Well, that's not here yet. But this is an important day for buying gold because there's a belief that it's going to bring good fortune. Then you have tons of different festivals throughout the year that has gold as a reason to buy. But you have the wedding season that just ended. November to March, gold demand spikes. It's a traditional gift in India. It's an important part of the wedding ceremonies. So that's really important. So you have these religious and cultural practices, and it makes it pretty important for India. Now, what about the rest of the world? China. Well, gold demand peaks around the Chinese New Year. That was January through February, or January or February. It was kind of depending on where it lies. It could be a layover. It could be, you know, depending where it is. But anyway, the Chinese New Year, which lasts a little while, gold's a traditional gift. It symbolizes prosperity, good fortune. Middle East. You have gold purchases that increase during Ramadan and Eid. These celebrations are often a time when gold is given out as gifts or even dowries for weddings. Turkey, gold buying, it really tremendous amount of gold buying during wedding season. And that's particularly in the summer months. So these are patterns that we know of. These are things that we see and how cultures and traditions and seasonal events and holidays really play an important role in the gold buying worldwide. So you combine this all together, the FOMO, the technical, the psychological, the need to have something in uncertainty, inflation hedge, and all these celebrations. I think that's what is going on and why Goldman Sachs recently, I believe, put a year-end target of 3,300, about 8.5% from where we are today. So gold is doing its thing. So not a bad position to maybe keep some in your portfolio these days, right? But at the same time, realize that it is one of those assets that doesn't pay a dividend, doesn't have any fundamental value. It doesn't have earnings. can't look at, oh, what's the gold PE ratio? That doesn't work. But it is something that a lot of people are really warming up to these days. Maybe a little bit too much right now, but that's what it is. I want to take a quick break. And then I want to get back to our discussion, or I want to get to our discussion with our guest. So let's just take a quick time out, and then we're going to get it on and spend some time with our guest. So let's take a minute and talk about Interactive Brokers, because there's a question that I want to ask you. Will the year-over-year change in the U.S. Consumer Price Index exceed 2.4% in March of 2025 at Interactive Brokers? The Yes Forecast contract was recently priced at 62%. You can trade your prediction at Interactive Brokers. If you agree, buy yes. If you don't, buy no. Correct predictions earn $1 and incorrect ones settle at zero. IBKR Forecast Trader lets you use exchange-listed forecast contracts to trade your opinion on yes or no questions on political, economic, and climate indicators. Plus, you'll earn 3.83% APY on your investment with an interest-like incentive coupon. Forecast contracts are not suitable for all investors. Check out the data, spot the trends, and make your prediction. Go to ibkr.com/forecast and start predicting today. So let's get to our guest now, David Gaffin. He's at Reuters. He's the U.S. breaking news company's editor. He's worked there for about 14 years. He did some stints as the U.S. energy editor, U.S. deputy markets editor. He's been doing business journalism for over 20 plus years. And that time he's covered 2008's financial crisis, the oil meltdown in 2020. He was nominated as a Lieb Award for a series of articles on the growth of stock buybacks in 2015. So we have a lot to talk about with David. He's been on several times before. So let's see what's going on here. So, David, how are you?
I'm doing well. How have you been?
I've been really good, thanks. So I just went over the intro into who you are, and I had a question as we're reading through this. The U.S. breaking news company's editor at Reuters. What exactly, and how do you define breaking news?
Yeah. So that's basically the biggest stories that are happening at a given moment. That's the newest thing that's coming out, that's moving markets, that everybody's paying attention to within the business world. You know, so anything involving, you know, obviously during earnings season, pretty obvious when you have the biggest earnings reports that are out. Everything that's going on lately with tariffs, obviously, as it affects businesses, is a big deal. A CEO resigns, you know, some sort of scandal. That's all, you know, anything we have to be on top of, getting updates out quickly, looking at what we're going to do in terms of our coverage. Are we going to do a sidebar? Are we, you know, who are we calling? What is our, you know, game plan? That's kind of everything I have to be in front of and on top of to make sure everything looks great.
So I have two parts of this same similar question. How hard is it once again to try to get through the first line of breaking news, which is Trump all day, all the time?
Yeah, you know, it sucks a lot of the air out of the room. You definitely have that correct. And I think that our approach has been to try to do this as sober as possible, to try to avoid overstating the importance of his role in certain stories, but realizing that he's doing a lot of things that, you know, do affect the economy and the business world very greatly. And those things, you know, matter a lot, and we can't just ignore them. It's funny, though, we had several days in a row of a lot of activity from him, and then we had one day where it seemed to be quiet, and all of a sudden the DeepSeek thing out of China jumped up out of nowhere, and that was the rest of that day. So, you know, we have a lot. It's hard to not see him as the forefront of everything, but there are quite a few other things going on that go on with, you know, M&A and other aspects of business. There's definitely a lot to keep us busy, but, you know, you're not wrong. It does take up a lot of room.
So when you look back, and you covered things like in 2008, the financial crisis. I know you did a lot on that. 2020 with the oil market meltdown. That was unbelievable, where we went negative. We're like, huh, what's that? And what are you as a writer and dealing with this? How do you What are the biggest challenges you face, right, during that time? Because things are moving fast and furious.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, they have that old cliche that we're the, you know, first draft of history. And that very much feels true. You know, we're always sort of saying, are we calibrating this correctly? Are we getting this right? Are we buying too much spin from those who are saying things, who are the official authorities in this realm? You know, in this case, it's this administration. Can we make sure that we get context in there as quickly as possible, that so that people don't just see what we're doing as stenography? So that I'm not just saying, okay, Trump said this, we write it down, put it back out there, and then you're just regurgitating. What is, you know, the essential context behind what has happened? Be it announcements at the White House of some new investment by some company in a various part of the country, be it the tariffs, be it, you know, anything else that's going on. So much that happens on the fastest times, just as you mentioned, two of the biggest examples, that oil market meltdown and the financial crisis, it was hard to sort of get a bead on, you know, well, what is the truth of what's happening exactly right now? And often it looks very, very foggy. And that's, you know, the biggest challenge. Do I even understand this? You know, what are all of these little markets that people hadn't heard of back then? It was, you know, LIBOR, and it was all the repo markets. What does this mean? Why do we care? And these things are the financial arteries of our modern economy. And that's what it takes to explain that kind of stuff. But if we don't know that, you know, we're not going to do the best job. It's a definite challenge to do all that and be fast as possible.
Right. And you're not, it's not like, oh, it's 9:30, we start the day. This stuff goes on throughout the night.
Absolutely. Yeah, it doesn't change. Yeah,
you know, it's funny. Sure. It's funny. I could tell you that for a couple of years, I can remember that all was quiet on my cell phone. Like the news alerts were like, okay, for a while they were pretty peaked up there, right? And then they die down. And then, you know, unless it's really important, the overnight stuff can wait till the morning usually. But sometimes you get those news alerts that just will light up your phone in the middle of the night. They kind of, you know, push through. But now things have changed since the last 2 years. It was quiet. Now, all of a sudden, I'm getting almost every night there's some unusual event going on and pushing the alerts. I don't know if this kind of environment supercharges the news cycle or the news cycle is supercharging the cycle. I don't know what's coming first.
It's hard to tell sometimes, isn't it? Yeah. I think that obviously we're sort of in a very heightened period where everything does feel, you know, super, you know, charged in a lot of ways. And it leaves people, I think, at a loss of, well, how much do I pay attention to and how much can I, you know, safely ignore? And I think there are a lot of people who are going to want to say, you know, I've got to tune out most of this. That's not, you know, an easy decision to make. You know, we're all supposed to want to be informed and, you know, be part of, you know, public understanding of what's happening. And then, you know, so you have this sort of constant, you know, barrage, and it's a lot.
I do wonder sometimes if the intent is to wear us down so that we don't watch. I mean, I know there was a time that I'd be like, okay, I'll watch CNN. I'll flip over to Fox. I'll flip over to Bloomberg. I'll flip over to, I don't know, pick your poison, what it is, right? I'll go through all the different news cycles to see what's going on throughout the evening, let's say, to catch up on a few things. And these days, no, doesn't happen. These days, to be honest with you, I do rely on Reuters. I find it to be very fair and unbiased. Bloomberg.
Thank you.
A few others. And that's it. I mean, I just can't go. And by the way, is it Reuters or Reuters?
You said it right the first time. Reuters. Absolutely.
I've had only because I've had arguments with people. So if you're listening, it's Reuters. It's not Reuters.
Yep. Absolutely. I can completely see where you're coming from. To me, you know, being able to, I think that one thing people don't sort of get sometimes when consuming media is that, you know, from our perspective, is that people want to consume at their own pace. And sometimes their own pace simply means, you know, reading, if it's online, in print, or what have you. You know, I consume most of what I get through reading as well, because it allows me to consume at my own pace. I read part of a story. If I don't want to keep going, I'll switch to something else, or I'll close that browser window. The television or digital or things like that, it's all being delivered to me.
It's a push versus a pull.
It is absolutely a push versus a pull. And I don't think that that's a small thing. I think that matters. I feel like in some cases why podcasting has become so popular, you know, you can, you know, consume it at your leisure, but you know, the best of them, you know, like this one, it takes things at, you know, the pace it wants to. It is similar to radio. It's just a voice in your ear. It's meant to be soothing, something like a conversation. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's very important. And, you know, people lament, of course, not seeing long form journalism anymore. But in a lot of ways, this is long form. You know, this is meant to be, right. You know, not 3 minutes. I mean, you know, the short ones, you know, and I listen to quite a few, are maybe 30. And then you get the ones that run up to an hour and a half to 2 hours, depending. But if it's someone you like listening to, that's a great thing.
So it's interesting because this is, as you said, long form journalism in a way, obviously. But the difference is that I think personally, the difference is how we consume things these days at our, maybe it's we've been trained or brainwashed, I don't know. But it used to be that you would consume information and make your own determination. The voice of the reader was what you had in your mind. The intonations on the words, the speed, the emphasis, it was all kind of like what you would make of it. Does that make sense? You know, because
yes,
you would use your, I guess it's almost like reading a Harry Potter book. You read this, you read the descriptives, you read and as you're going through it, you have your imagination that is creating that vision because you're reading, you're interpreting, you're going through this process and it's coming out all at once with what you're reading and then you're envisioning, if that makes some sense, right?
Yeah, that does make sense.
And then these days, people don't have the ability to do that. I really believe that, right? Not everybody, but we've been trained to like, okay, well, what is it? You tell me what it is and I'll just be done with it. I don't need to think about it. And I think that's the difference today and why long-form journalism, not from a podcast, because still in a podcast where we have the tonal intonations and we talk about things in a certain way and we get excited or we go through things, rush through things, slow down through things, explain things. It's a little bit different. But when you had long-form, there wasn't very little feedback mechanism there.
Correct.
And you're only you reading it and you trying and you're like, well, I don't understand that. There's nobody there to say to somebody else, you know, stop, explain it. It just a totally different thing. And I think it's a dying, I hate to say this. I'm sorry. I apologize. But it's kind of like it's been dying. Unfortunately, I say that because it's brilliant.
Yep. I think it goes back and forth. And I agree with you though. And I think it's something that we, you know, media companies have struggled with the digital side of things, the, you know, even swifter delivery than before, the shorter form video and that kind of thing. I mean, it's still, you know, obviously we have to play in there and it's not an area I'm as involved in, but you know, to me, the question that goes with it is that does that contain the same level of understanding of media literacy that, you know, people in our generation and older kind of, you know, at least grew up with, you know, and that's not everybody. I mean, it's clearly a lot of people that have none of that, but you know, are you understanding the sourcing of what you're getting, you know, where is that coming from rather than just, I saw this, therefore it is true.
Right. Right. Yeah. Now, but with that, with this discussion, and we're going to talk about, don't worry, we're going to talk about some things related to current market events and all, but where do you think the role of AI then is? Because that's the next...
That is the next thing. Yeah. And so the thing that I talk about with journalism a lot with AI is that, of course, AI can't get scoops. AI can't talk to sources on the phone. I mean, AI can't do those things. You know, and it is in a sort of more primitive era when it comes to that because it is only learning based on what it can, you know, absorb. And that completely depends on your inputs. So, you know, we use it at Reuters, but we use it in very limited capacities to, you know, help ourselves with summarization of some notes and things like that and, you know, that kind of thing. But it's not like we can really, you know, get there with writing articles or that kind of thing. It's very, still very primitive, you know,
yep.
And we have some significant handbrakes when it comes to that kind of thing.
Yeah, I like it for first level research. Right.
Yep.
For give me an idea about this or look into that. Or my favorite is just to rewrite something and clean it up. Right. This way, you know, first generation was writing in Word and having like an underline with red and saying that word is wrong or right or blue and you need a comma.
Yes.
But utilizing some of these other tools to just rewrite something and just clean it up and maybe make it a little more polished.
Yes.
That's kind of what I like.
Yeah.
I mean,
same here. And, you know, we have tools that will allow us to do things like, you know, a lot of our articles have bullet points on them that summarize them. We can use AI to create those, and then we have the option to accept them or reject them. Right. And I tend to, you know, I tend to like them more than not. But at the same time, when you ask it to create headlines, I often reject those because I find that they're a little too stilted or they're not interesting.
That's an art.
And that's exactly. And that's where the divide is, you know, between the art of a headline and a bunch of bullet points that sort of summarize things, which is a bit more rote.
Well, let's talk about some of the topics you've been talking about, thinking about, writing about, digging into. I guess we'll have to start off with this because everybody's talking about this. It's almost to a point that I said, I think last week, that CNBC was actually talking about this particular topic more than they were talking about and asking every single guest ad nauseum, what do they think the Fed's going to do? Because that was a year's worth of that.
Sure.
You know, every single guest that would come on the same question. Now every guest gets this question. Tell me about the tariffs and how that impacts or doesn't impact. And is it just a bargaining tool or not? Even though President Trump said a couple of days ago, it's not. It's something that's going to stay on for a foreseeable future and, in fact, be permanent. But tariffs, I mean, what have you been writing about and what are you seeing?
Right. So we seem to be all tariffs all the time here, don't we?
Yeah.
And we're certainly writing about it a lot, in part because, and the initial thinking is exactly what you said. A lot of people said, well, this is obviously a negotiating tool or something to that effect. But, you know, he and several of the people in his administration seem to be, you know, viewing tariffs as a means to their own end and not as a means to some sort of, you know, improved outcomes for something else. Like, you know, it's related initially to immigration, but in his first term, he used a number of threats and, you know, cajoling and browbeating to revamp the NAFTA treaty, which was clearly, you know, big on his mind. And ultimately, there weren't a lot in the way of the tariffs after that. He clearly wanted to go after China. And a lot of companies did do the nearshoring. They moved stuff back to Mexico and Canada. But right now, the tariffs seem to be a means to an end. And
What is that? Back up. Let me stop you. What means to what end?
I guess, you know, he views tariffs themselves as a virtue or a virtuous sort of thing. He has referred numerous times to, you know, the high tariffs that existed during William McKinley's presidency when we were a very different type of economy, in a very different kind of world economy at the time. So, you know, the idea being that, you know, he will use tariffs as a way to augment and ultimately try to replace some of what regular Americans pay in taxes. It's something that hasn't been used in a very, very long time, more than a century, really, you know, where it was a significant part of the tax collection of this country. In fact, it's, you know, now it's pretty small. I don't have the exact percentage, but it's a couple of points of percentage points, you know, on levies that come from foreign goods. And he and his Treasury Secretary and his trade advisors have talked about a need to sort of reset the economy or to, you know, with the idea that there's going to be a certain pain that comes before we get onto the other side of whatever this is. And that's a level of uncertainty that I think a lot of people are unclear how to deal with, especially if they see it as, you know, something more than just an idle threat and more, you know, an actual feature that they want to implement, which kind of goes and runs against the direction that world economies have been going for a very, very long time. And that's going to imply a very long period of adjustment, and which means, well, I mean, what could it mean? You've looked at it a lot. It could be, you know, job losses. It could be, sure, there could be nearshoring. There could be onshoring, but, you know, it's also higher prices. It's also disruption to supply chains. And not a switch that gets flipped. It brings up a lot of thoughts. It has a lot of, you know, tentacles that we're still trying to suss out, and that's just from today. The most recent, round of auto tariffs, which presages a whole bunch of other tariffs that will come through throughout, you know, the month of April, it seems.
So just to be clear, William McKinley, he's 25th president of the United States. He was he served between 1897 and he was assassinated, actually, in 1901.
Correct.
Keep me honest here for a second, okay?
Yeah.
Do we have a robust global trade back then?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, I think you know the answer. The answer is no, we do not. I think that—
Did we have planes? You know, did we have airplanes?
And the thing of it is that, you know, people talk about McKinley this way, but apparently, and I don't know the exact history, he was a very big proponent of tariffs while he was serving in Congress from Ohio, which is where he was from, which was a very industrial state, certainly back then, and kind of, you know, had to deal with some of the ramifications of it as a president some years later. But it was a very, very different world, a different economy. We were an emerging economy, really, at that time, a rapidly growing industrializing economy that had limited amounts of world trade, and certainly, you know, where you would see why, you know, one of the two parties at the time, the Republican Party, was very big on the tariff as the platform that was in the platform for every candidate from Abraham Lincoln through at least to McKinley, and not, you know, and past that. That, but it was a very different time, as you say. There were no planes.
It was 1897. Yeah. He put up together the Dingley tariffs. And the idea back then, though, was to protect manufacturers and protect factory workers from foreign competition. Okay, got that. Okay, that's great.
Yes.
But the problem is that when you say it's a much different world, that first level thinking, right, that one step above knuckle-dragging thinking, by the way, of it in today's world is far removed from what we actually do here. We're a service-oriented country. We do some manufacturing. Yeah. But we made the conscious decision for a reason to offshore our manufacturing to make prices lower for our goods here. And
correct.
We wanted to do that because we did not want to work in, I don't know, pick what you want, the widget shop that pays X amount of dollars with no air conditioning and very limited benefits, right? We felt like, you know what, if we did so, we'd have to have benefits, air conditioning, retirement, and all that. And a widget, instead of costing 5 cents, is going to cost, you know, 80 cents. So we said, you know what, send it over to Thailand, send it over to Cambodia, send it over to China, or wherever you choose to say. And now we're just pissed off about it because I don't understand what we're trying to protect. I don't get it.
Right. I'm not sure about myself. I guess the first thing that I would also think about when we think about this is that, you know, what I think that some of these folks aren't really considering is that, you know, we were operating, and this is the long tail end of people who have been operating in the memory of a world where the basic industrial base of most of the major world economies had been completely destroyed by World War II. I mean, we were producing more than 90% of the world's cars. That is not sustainable. It was not sustainable. It produced great prosperity. Yet it may have been an utter anomaly. There is no way to recreate that, not when labor is cheaper elsewhere. That's not to say that, you know, there have been great actors in this in other parts of the world as far as, you know, a lot of things people bring up with China that are quite valid in terms of concerns that people have. But, you know, as you've just pointed out, it's a very different world. Part of the decisions made were not just, you know, elite consensus, which they were, but it was also just untenable to think that we were going to preserve that. And yet it still has a long, you know, sort of memory in a lot of people's minds that affects the thinking of how we're, you know, trying to manage this economy right now, particularly through tariffs.
I just have a hard time understanding how we get through this right now with this as the backstop of our way of doing things. But I mean, look, the markets aren't thrilled about it either. And the truth of the matter is, I'll ask you this one other question, I guess, on this. We believe, I think everybody across the board believes or hopes to believe, that we are all about capitalism here, right? And capitalism is based on there's a lot of different things that are based on, right? But you know, the money will flow to where it is treated best. And in terms of all that, tariffs don't seem to fit that bill. It seems to be like this weird thing that we're creating governmental beneficiaries to one side versus another, and at us, of course. But when we look at the world and where we want to capture, why did we do our best to industrialize other nations? Is it because we're really nice people? No. We want them to buy stuff from us. Why has it been over the last number of years that the educational of the poor and certain people in the United States has been such a priority? It's not because everybody's being nice. The reality is that it was paid for by the corporations for the impact for 15, 20 years from now, where everybody's going to have a better job, make more money, and then buy stuff. Buy stuff. That's right. What this is all about. And this whole idea of making stuff to buy more expensive that I know the other countries, quote unquote, pay.
Yeah.
But, you know, the truth is we're paying somehow.
Yes.
Somehow or another, because the price is going to go up. I don't know. It just, it seems to me that, you know, you use the word untenable, but this is just a situation that can't play out in a great way if we're going to use it as the only tool, that seems to me to be the only tool in our economic toolbox right now.
Right. It does feel like, and, you know, I'm not, of course, you know, serving in any political administration, but that there is a lot of tinkering with economic levers, sort of with the notion that they are independent of one another. You know, It's, you know, yes, in this weird ideal world, you would, you know, in their minds, you would have a change in where our goods are being produced. There is a long valley between that on how you get to that point, if you can get to that point. And other things can happen. You know, you can have, you know, a recession. You can have job losses. You can find out that things that you planned don't work out. And as you were talking about capitalism, it's something I've been thinking about too. I mean, you are, you know, assuming that millions of independent economic actors will do what you want them to do, and they may not do that. Right. And, you know, that is something that will happen, you know, independent of decisions made by a small handful of people when it is not all waiting on them. You know, that feels like a, you know, folly to me.
Yep.
Let's
move
concerning.
Over. Let's move over to, because I could rail on this for hours. But let's let's go over to valuations. The last year was characterized as this boom year for AI / even quantum computing, although there was no real revenue shown from that, but from the quantum. But the continuation of this major change in technology, probably the third turning, I think, maybe it's the fourth, but the third of computer age. Big one back in, what, early 2000s, right? Big consumer-sided change. A couple others in between, and then here we go with this AI, but also a big rebuild, refresh, change, and valuations went a little bit wonky. Right. The idea that I bring this up all the time, that back in the day, Dell, if you remember and watched Dell over the years, it was just, you know, on fire. But the assumption, if their earnings continue to grow at the same level that they were over the next 5 years, that each and every one of us, every one of us in the United States would have five computers on our desktop at a time. And that's right. Just stupid. Right. This is not going to happen. AI kind of went that to what direction also. And there was money spent. But have you been looking into any of the, I would say any of the programs that many of these high tech companies, the Microsofts, Amazons, have, where and Google, where they're funding other companies for the AI race, which are then turning around and buying things from NVIDIA and all that, but also then pumping that money that they're giving from Microsoft back onto the Azure cloud and boosting the profitability of Microsoft. Have you seen any of that?
I've seen only a little bit of it, and I must confess I'm not the biggest expert on it all. I do have some real questions about, you know, how this spending sort of doesn't do anything but, as you seem to be suggesting, kind of loop back on itself. And it feels like that's a kind of thing that continues until it cannot continue anymore. We've noticed, you know, a number of analysts, like the folks at TD Cowen, have pointed out the way in which Microsoft has had a whole bunch of data center projects that they were using, and they've just abandoned them because they have oversupply. And, you know, as a result, you know, you start to question, you know, if they're going to continue to be able to train every single bit of all of these AI things, and if that's going to be, you know, well, money well spent.
Yeah, because there's still question as to how you monetize this. I mean, you look at and the biggest question I have is Google. You know, the whole idea is, Google's going to train this great, you know, monster to take over and all that. I'm thinking, yeah, but what if they do that? How are they going to do search? Like search paid for, you know, sponsored.
Yeah.
And by the way, of all the AI models that I've looked at, Google's has had the most personal failure rate to me. In other words, incorrect things that come out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I find, I don't know what your experience is, but I use two or three of them, three of them, I guess. And it's the worst. Stopped using it.
Actually. Yeah. I can't say whether I've had real success with any of them. But I probably don't use it quite enough to be really well, you know, suited to say, you know, it's working or doesn't work. I mean, I know what I hear anecdotally.
So what about valuations? I mean, what's going on with some of the largest tech names? I mean, is this an issue? Is this, I mean, they've come down a bit, right? They finally started to come down.
Yeah, they finally started to come down a bit. We saw some of the wind come out of the sails there. I mean, the DeepSeek thing was part of it. People started to perhaps, you know, diversify again and sort of shift, you know, but for a long time, it was that whole Mag7 versus the world kind of thing that pushed all of their valuations to some really high levels. It still seems like a bunch of them are very high and they're all built on, you know, very lofty assumptions about where those earnings are going to go. Yeah. You know, I can see that some are still in there, you know, on a forward PE. There's some that are still in like the 50s and that kind of stuff. I mean, you know, NVIDIA seems to remain on the lower side in part because, you know, their revenues so far have been as strong as they have been. So yes, even as the stock goes up, their, you know, their PE, forward PE is still, well, based on some of this, given they're a growth tech company, seems to be a little bit less, you know, lofty. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that right company in the right place seems to be able to be something that's, you know, successful for investors for a long, long time. It mm-hmm. it continues to run up. The Cisco Systems was like this all those years ago. It's a pick and shovel kind of thing. It doesn't last forever, of course. But, you know, some of the other ones, though, have, you know, very high price earnings ratios. But it also strikes me that a lot of what we're seeing is some real questions about things like, you know, whether, you know, all of the next companies to come in will see the same kind of, you know, big valuations. I noticed that CoreWeave company, you know, NVIDIA's backing that one. And they are looking to, you know, reduce the size of their IPO that was originally expected to be, you know, more than, you know, much more than it's expected now. It's like, I think a 23% decline in what that IPO was supposed to be.
Oops.
You know, yeah.
Oopsie.
You know, yeah. So, and it's been a tough year already, you know, for the IPO market that was supposed to be a very good one. So that's,
well, you have interest rates that are up and you have an environment that people have uncertainty. That's the problem for IPOs. Economic growth. You know, we saw last week some GDP, that's fine. You know, we saw some employment numbers that look okay. There's some issues about around the edges of that, of whether or not that's a trend or it's a 1 or 2 monther. And then there's some discussion about durable goods sales, maybe some pull forward of that due to the fear about tariffs in the beginning of the year. There's also some issue about manufacturing versus services. Very mixed, as I see it. I'm not putting words in your mouth. I'm just setting the stage for your discussion. Very mixed, right? There's a lot of talk of hard. Now they're using, every once in a while, they'll pull this out of the bag of tricks, you know, the guys. Oh, yeah. The hard data versus the soft data. You know, it's like the weather excuse. Yeah. It's all the same concept of just trying to reach for something. And when they start doing that, when they start looking for the hard data, when you start seeing those phrases pop up, hard data versus soft data, it signals to me that people are reaching. How do you see what's going on right now from an economic standpoint, looking forward, maybe US and globally?
Yeah, so there are two things about that. I mean, the one thing about the hard versus soft data, I mean, I see what you're saying, but I do see that where people would recognize limitations in things like sentiment surveys, if people continue to spend the money, you know, their, you know, how their view and their actual, you know, actions they take may be different. Just the same, though, it would be hard not to look at consumer and small business sentiment surveys and not be, you know, somewhat concerned as far as where, you know, the economy is going to be going right now on a U.S. basis. I mean, there's some real numbers out there that do, you know, make people have some pause here. The thing that I am going to be looking for in the next, you know, couple of weeks for sure, as we move closer to the earnings period, is do we, as the result of these sentiment surveys and the uncertainty around tariffs and the kind of lack of a real picture that companies have, do we start to see them issue some negative pre-announcements, some warnings about, you know, trends? And if they do, are they going to throw the kitchen sink in there thanks to the uncertainty thing that they can use as a crutch?
Right.
That to me will be something that I think is
It's like spilling water. In other words, what Dave's talking about there is taking a giant glass of water and spilling it during a rainstorm so nobody sees it.
Yes.
You know, that's what he's talking about.
Good analogy.
That's what he's talking about when there is a, the kitchen sink we're going to find that, things aren't bad. It's not our fault. It's not company specific. It's everybody's got the problem. You know, that's what they look at there.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Continue
on.
I was going to say one thing we've noticed, and I think S&P has some data on this, and we're in the midst of trying to write about it, is that there are a lot of companies over the last 3 months that have mentioned tariffs or mentioned the word tariff either on investor calls or investor events and things like that. However, there have been a whole load of them that say they have not modeled for it within their growth and earnings outlook for the year.
Right.
Well, they're going to have to model for it now, or they're going to have to say something, and that is going to potentially produce some, nasty surprises.
The reason they didn't do so is because they didn't think it was going to happen. They thought this whole thing was going to blow over. We'll have to see. Now, you've written quite a lot about corporate strategies. You for years, one of the big things was buybacks and shareholder-friendly programs. But it seems, I don't know, to me, maybe I'm wrong about this, but is there we're in like a buyback desert all of a sudden. I don't remember hearing major corporate buyback plans like we were seeing a couple of years back, right? As a matter of fact, I went on Google Trends and I looked at, that's just obviously from a search term. It's been coming down. This term, share buyback, stock buyback, buybacks, it's like non-existent.
Yes. It clearly has tailed off as some sort of thing where people are announcing a lot of them. But I think that they've pretty much continued kind of a pace. And that's just because they have so many companies have put these programs into place and then they just sort of regularly just re-up them and keep sort of rolling through with buybacks. It's become such a typical way of using cash, and so because people, companies often when they don't see opportunities, that's just kind of what they spend their money on. I've always wondered whether it's a way of, propping up a stock price in favor of, that as opposed to, actual investment. But, that kind of financialization has been around for a good long while.
Financialization. I like that. That's also, we also, there's other words for this. Magic. It's financial wizardry. It's, there's all sorts of financial alchemy is another one for that. Now, you've seen a lot of change over the last number of years in things like DEI, or even when we look at the whole idea of ESG. I mean, that was like a hot spot, right? I'll tell you a quick story. I'll set the stage for this. Many, many years ago, I was at an event. I don't usually do these that often. Every once in a while, something will catch my eye. I'm like, I'll do that. When I say not that often, it's like years in between, right? And but this caught my eye. I'm like, they're gonna. It was Allianz. They were gonna talk about ESG. I'm like, what the hell is that? And I see what the title, what it means, and environmental, social governance. I'm like, okay. What are they going to talk about? You know what? I said, I'm interested. They give me a free steak for lunch. I'm going. Right? That's pretty much the whole thought process that went on there. It was close to me too. So I put on a jacket. I went to a couple of weeks later. Went to lunch, and then going through this whole ESG thing. And the whole time, I'm like, what's happening here? And I'm like, raising my hand, excuse me, and they're like, there's only like 15 of us in the room. And I'm like, Mr. Obnoxious. I'm like, as Forrest Gump would say, I'm not a smart man. I'm like, could you please explain to me what you're talking about exactly? Well, we have an index that this is that. We feel that we've tracked this and it's going to be better for the companies. I'm like, well, who fits what? Is it the company that does this? Are you going to fit them in? And how is the company then not going to come around the other side and game the whole system? I was asking all these questions back then, right? And I finally got to the point. I'm like, okay, nice. I like the idea. Right? It's a good idea that we should have all this going on. But I'm like, I'm calling BS on this deal because what you're going to do is you're going to blow this stuff up and it's just going to get out of hand, which it did, by the way. Then we had DEI. Right, DEI was a big thing, which was no more than, to a degree, affirmative action in the corporate world, to a degree. Not entirely, right? There's also other things that came along with that. But now we are on the other side of that pendulum entirely.
Yes,
where
that's true.
You wrote about Amazon's decision to remove references to inclusion and diversity from its annual report, right? Which is a big reflection on the broader trends in America's approach to diversity initiatives. Talk to me a little bit what we found out, what you wrote about and found out from that particular circumstance.
Yeah. So, you know, Amazon did this back in February, and it's something that we've been looking for throughout annual reports in this, you know, these last few months. And simply put, you know, you can just glance at an annual report when it hits, you know, the SEC filings, you know, because everybody has to have that. And you can pretty much go and search through and see what the references are to things like, you know, both ESG, diversity, inclusion and equity, or equity and inclusion, as it were, and how they've changed that as you see corporate America kind of really, you know, retreating from it. And, you know, a lot of companies have, as you've pointed out, been scaling back these diversity initiatives, which have been, you know, became a big thing over the last 5 years, particularly in the aftermath of the murder of George Floyd. And, you know, they've, you know, try to couch it sometimes. Sometimes they say they're moving it to other departments. Sometimes they're, you know, shifting things. Sometimes they're trying to recast what it means or does not mean. But certainly there's been this sort of broad overall retreat. And then the real question was, to me, is did it do anything in the first place? Was there progress made in terms of trying to, you know, better represent, you know, underrepresented groups in management, especially if you're a company that caters to consumers of all kinds? Or, you know, was it, you know, something that ended up being, you know, cosmetic? Because, you know, there's, you know, merit in all of it in some ways, but, you know, sometimes you see these trends and people jump on them and everybody puts this, you know, word in their language, and then it, you know, does not accomplish the goals that it has set out to do. And then you end up facing, you know, the anger both from, you know, those who didn't like this in the first place, and then those who believe that this is a broken promise. And so it's created a lot of thorny situations where nobody seems to be happy about it at all. You know,
you want my answer if you're asking the question?
Go ahead.
First of all, The lack of authenticity with this is what troubles me. The lack of in 5 years, we turn it on. We don't just turn it on. We turn it on, okay? And then we then go to the other side when all of a sudden the new administration comes in because it aligned. The alignment was right there, right? And all of a sudden we turn it off. I mean, really says a lot about corporations, what they're trying to pull. The whole desire of whatever department it is to make corporations look like the good guys, but in fact, they just pull the rug out at the end. So they try to do what they think the masses think is the right thing. So it's not really their thought. In other words, they're not the ones that initiated it. It was pushed upon them, and they're like, okay, we'll do this because, you know, yeah, it's going to make us look good. And then once they can get out of it, they're like, okay, you know what? Ha ha. We were kidding. We didn't want to do it all along. We're out.
Yep. There does seem to be, you know, this sense that, you know, they're not exactly, you know, leading in terms of the thought here. It was, you know, adjust based on, you know, what the prevailing winds are. Sometimes you do have to adjust to your customers, obviously, but then, you know, and environments do change. But just the same, you know, I don't think you're incorrect to, you know, suggest that there's something a little bit, you know, fickle and very, you know, easily changed about all of this.
Yeah. And I know, listen, I know people that work for companies, and I know a couple of people that were the head of DEI, and the whole time they were telling me how ridiculous the whole thing was and the rules they had to do and what they had to do and who they had to put in on the boards and all that. It was like, what? They have no choice. And it didn't matter about, once again, it didn't matter about qualifications. It was only about race, skin color, or it could have been religion even, or it could have been where you're from. I'm like, well, how does that work? And isn't that anti, I don't know, the whole thing was just, and I'm not saying I'm for or against anything, it's just, the whole thing was just stunk to high hell is what I'm saying. Same thing with ESG. My point to the listeners here is this: why are we going down this path? Because you will see things written about, talked about, idealized about in the world of investing that you need to be really careful about. You need to look at this with a strange eye. Look at it as, you know, as be skeptical. And don't always be gullible to what is happening, because corporations are there to do something. They're there to make money. And by the way, it is why it is the greatest place to create wealth in the world is the stock market. Because companies are there trying their best every single day, every single way to make money. That's what they do. Right? Whether it's the buybacks that were like kind of like, huh, okay. Whether it's this DEI thing, like, okay. I mean, they thought it was all about, in the end, doing the right thing to a degree. But for what? For shareholders and, dare I say, for their pocket as well. As the leaders, and that's why we want. That's why we want to invest in that. That's the beauty of this. I'm turning this totally around now. Right? Doesn't mean everything's going to work and everything I'm going to agree with what they do, but that is the point of why corporate America, why capitalism, true capitalism, works. So just my little tidbit on it, sir.
Yeah, I think the only other thing I would say is that I imagine that there are quite a few companies that really did believe in it.
Yes,
and
I agree.
I think it's very true that, you know, there are a lot of people who, you know, may think that, you know, their broad-based thoughts about hiring and about promotions and about, you know, all these things are, you know, neutral and that kind of thing. But, you know, we do have blind spots. We do have things we don't see. And I think that, you know, that it was fair to, you know, reckon with that. And so it has been twisted to the idea that it was, you know, completely fake or something like that, which I don't believe. But obviously, you know, the commitment to this obviously seems to have been something that was very, very thin.
Yeah, no, right. It's like weak hands. Weak hands when you invest. That's what it was. So the weak hands and that's what troubled me. It wasn't the programs. It was what troubled me was went in as like we're being convinced is a good thing. And then it's like, wait a minute. You're abandoning this? I thought it was such a good thing. Now I'm confused. That's all I'm saying. Right. Because every company had their own program that did whatever it did. And I do agree, by the way, 100%. That there are those potential for not only weak spots, but, you know, maybe biases that we don't even know about. You know, this may be something something that we as a manager, as a owner, as a business person, or in life for that matter, maybe areas we're not really clear about how we have our own personal biases. And that goes for investing, too, that it's good sometimes to unearth and to turn upside down and shake it up a little bit. So that's, you know, who knows what, maybe what's left after the fact is better than what started. And that's all we could hope for.
Right.
David Gaffin at Reuters, I thank you as always for joining me and keep up the great work.
Thanks. Good to be here again. Nice to talk to you.
Thanks. And that's a wrap of another great episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me this week. Financial Literacy Month starts right now. So let's get it going. Let's get ourselves in line and thinking about what it is that we could do for that one thing that we're going to learn this month. One thing. Just one thing. Not two. Just one right now. Start baby steps, right? Let's get that going. And I'll talk to you next week. We have a great guest, Tim Knight. We're going to talk about the short side of the markets. Then we have coming up Manuel Bly, Brian Dress, Pat O'Hare from Briefing. Lots of people all the way through this month. It's going to be a bang up month. And I look forward to you being there with me. Thanks for joining me again. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.